This episode of CinemaJaw is sponsored by Overcast, a better podcast app than whatever you're using right now. Unless it's Overcast. Get Overcast for free on the App Store. Listening to CinemaJaw, the greatest movies podcast ever, recorded on location at Cards Against Humanity in Chicago. My name is Matt Kay, and with me is
Rad Movie Guy. And sitting inside the fish tank, as always, is Fill Me In Phil.
How's it going, guys?
This week on CinemaJaw, Matt, we get a room at the Hyatt Hotel as we cover our top five favorite hotel movies.
Why the Hyatt?
I just picked it up out of, I just randomly picked the Hyatt.
How about the Marriott?
Holiday Inn?
The Red Roof Inn?
I wouldn't go that low.
That's kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
That's more of a motel.
I think so, right?
Yeah. Have the Ritz-Carlton.
Ah, there you go. That's right. Where we would go as CinemaJaw.
Of course.
You know, of course. If we're going to record our podcast in any hotel, it's the Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah.
Do you know the nicest hotel you've ever stayed at?
I don't know. I mean, probably somewhere in Florida, like on a pseudo business trip with my dad. Although I think I was at one of the real fancy ones in New York City, maybe even the Ritz. I don't know.
Yeah.
How about you?
I'd have to think about it.
But in some nice ones.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, anytime you're in a hotel, it's kind of nice.
Yeah, we are doing our top five favorite hotel movies because we got invited out to record a podcast at a hotel.
Hey.
Right?
Speaking of nice hotels.
It's Chicago, so they got this new hip hotel. Plug for them. It's called the Moxie Hotel.
Yes.
And they actually have a broadcast booth in the lobby. So where you're checking in and where
the bar restaurant area is.
Right.
Yes. No, exactly. And let's not call it a broadcast booth because it is a hip place. This is a podcast booth.
Hmm. Besides that, we do have some more going on, don't we, Phil?
Oh, yeah. We're also going Eye for an Eye on Eighth Grade.
And we have a review of The Icarus Line Must Die.
Yeah. And on that note, Matt, you actually were able to interview the writer and director, Michael Grodner, plus the star, Joe Cardamone.
Yeah, yeah, and it was a real treat to talk to those guys after viewing this movie. So I really enjoyed it. Spoiler.
Absolutely. I'm excited to hear your review on that.
Mm.
It's a condensed episode.
It's a bit of a hodgepodge, right?
It is, and that is because the 4th of July weekend holiday actually lands right during our normal recording.
That's right.
So this is sort of a hodgepodge. We didn't want to miss a week, so.
We had all these components, so why not put them together?
I agree.
So here we are, even on a holiday.
It's awesome. And I'll just tell my story right now. This Haima Black, who's a friend of the show, and we really like the guy. He asked us to come out to the Moxie Hotel, something new. They got this podcast booth, as Matt has alluded to, and let's record a podcast there. People can hear you.
It's going to be a big event.
It was, and it was, right? But he gives us a few dates. We say we can't make it. It's during some basically business hours, work hours. It's tough for me to get over there. I finally agree to a time. I say, hey, I got it this day
off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I can make this work. I ask Matt, oh, are you sure? Yeah, absolutely. Get back to Haima. Does this day work? Yes. It seems like everything came together
for us. It's a lock.
Wow. Everything came up Milhouse. We're locked in. We're going to do our top five hotel movies in a hotel. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to this. It's a Monday. The Tuesday before we're going to record there at the hotel, I get called in for jury duty. Now, Matt, have you ever been called in for jury
duty? So, yeah, I've gotten the call numerous times, but I've never been selected. So you know how you're supposed to call 24 hours in advance to find out if you're selected? So I've never gotten to that second stage. Luckily, knock on wood.
Stage one was call. Same with me. I was an alternate at that point. They said call 24 hours ahead. I call. Yes, I got to go through the process. I get selected. It ends up being a murder trial here in Chicago. I don't want to go too much into it since we're broadcasting out, but had to serve on the jury, and the trial ended up going 5 days. If you see here, we started on a Tuesday. It went Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I wanted it to end on Friday, but no, it continued on into Monday, which meant everything I wanted to do, which was do the top five show at the Moxie Hotel, was ruined. I could not get out to record the podcast, and Haima had to fill in and just do it with you and Haima.
It's a crime on top of a crime.
So I'm just going to have to give you my number one after we listen to you and Haima's list.
It's okay. So, I mean, you did your civic duty,
Ryan. I did my civic duty.
There you go.
Maybe we should do jury movies sometime.
We should. Hey, That's not a bad idea.
All right. We do want to get to Eye for an Eye, and it's an exciting one. Phil?
Eye for an Eye, eighth grade. A teenager, Kayla, tries to survive the last week of her disastrous eighth grade year before leaving to start high school. The film stars Josh Hamilton, Daniel Zargadrio, and Elsie Fisher as Kayla. It was written and directed by Bo Burnham. Rye, we throw it on over to you.
I mean, come on. We've talked about this film already at, I think it was our summer movie preview. Eighth grade came up. Obviously, we have friends in the film critic community here, Brian Tellerico, people who you have heard on Cinema Jaw, and I see their social medias. You can't help but see their tweets or their Facebook posts, and a lot of them went out to Sundance when this premiered, and it was the buzz of Sundance. Everybody loved it. I was super excited, and it actually played at the Chicago Film Critics Festival. And I happen to be out of town on vacation.
I know, me too.
So
such
I
a bummer.
Missed it. So I am super excited for eighth grade. Very, very interested.
I think the studio should just change their name to A20 Finterested at this point, because that's what I am interested by anything they do. This one especially, and for all the reasons you mentioned.
Phil, you just got out of eighth grade. You interested in this?
yeah, I actually am, for different reasons. I loved Bo Burnham when he was like in the beginning of his YouTube career. I actually went and saw him once when I was in high school.
He's a YouTuber?
That's where he started, yeah. Mm-hmm. He started making like YouTube songs and like goofy little videos. Then he went into like doing stand-up specials with the songs. And he's a really interesting guy, and he's got a lot of like very funny but heartfelt material. I remember like when he was becoming famous, when I was in high school, it was like my junior year because I was in pre-calc, they had made rumors about this movie. And that was like, what? I mean, I don't know, over 8 years at this point or something like that. So yeah, I'm excited. I think it's pretty rad.
Three interesteds for eighth grade. We're going to have to get a review of this one.
Oh yeah, I'm really excited to see this one.
As I mentioned, I missed the top five hotel movies over at the Moxie. But Matt, you filled in nicely, didn't you?
I sure did. Check your bags, because here we go.
Joining me is a man who's been on the show before, and we'll have to look up exactly when that was, but it was years ago. Haima Black, welcome to Cinema Jaw, sir.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me back here.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me to this Moxie Hotel, the Sound Off podcast series.
So. Yeah. It's a live podcast series here at the Moxie Hotel, which is a new hotel in River North, right where near the Rock and Roll McDonald's used to be. So we're at LaSalle and Grand, brand new property, really cool spot. I'm doing some projects with them, and I'm excited about it.
When people say, what do? What's your answer?
That's a good question, because I send a lot of like pitch emails, and like depending on who I am emailing, that definition changes. So by and large, the big things that I do right now as of this moment is I teach at Columbia College. I teach entrepreneurship at Columbia College. I'm a podcaster myself. I like have a podcast network. I'm a host of a podcast. And then I also teach a podcasting course. And then in between that, I also do like live events, workshops. I'm just, like you said, I try to do a lot just to keep busy.
Yeah. And as far as like podcasting goes, you're being modest, because at least in Chicago, you're pretty much the pod father.
Well, that's super nice.
You've been doing it longer than anybody, right? I mean, you started in
2005. Yeah. So I just happened to be early on it. And, you know, to be fair, I was working at Q101, the late, great Q101 radio station here in Chicago. Most Chicagoans remember it, yeah.
The alt station here.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. You wanted to hear like Stone Temple Pilots or Beastie Boys or whatever, like that was Q101.
Right. Good music.
Yeah. And so I started there when I was like 15. And then by 2005, podcasting was starting to creep into existence. But I was working at a radio station. I was working at the Apple store, teaching people how to use iTunes and iPods.
That's kind of fortuitous.
And then I was also doing artist interviews for a magazine called Illinois Entertainer, which I still do sometimes. And so, like, if I had not figured out that you could combine the digital part, the artist interviews, and the broadcast part, it would have been really stunningly stupid of me. I just had all the ingredients in front of me. It really would have been like if I just had, like, dough, cheese, sauce and pepperoni on a table, and someone's like, how brilliant, you made pizza. And you'd be like, well, if I didn't figure that out, I would have been kind of dense.
I know you're actually, speaking of podcasting, building a new studio, and you've got classes going on and all that stuff.
Yeah. So the kind of short condensed version is, in addition to my own podcasting work under the name Dynasty Podcast, which is the name of my company, I also teach a podcasting class. I teach it through Airbnb. Has a platform now within the site called Experiences. And the idea is that you can, you know, if you're going to a city where you don't know anybody and you're like, well, I'm going to New York, but I don't want to just do touristy stuff like go see the Statue of Liberty and go see Times Square. You can sign up for experiences where, like, suddenly you're going to be hanging out with somebody who's like a local and they're going to take you to like the neighborhood bars or teach you how to make homemade pasta or other types of food, or they're going to like show you the different comedy clubs. It's just you're signing up for an experience with an actual local.
It's for some authenticity.
Absolutely. So that you're not just doing like Millennium Park and the Bean and like Navy Pier on your trip.
Right.
So I offer an experience through that platform on Airbnb, and it's a podcast class. And that's been really great and people have loved it. I've been really lucky. We got about 75 five-star reviews over the last year. So as an extension of that and my own podcasting work, I have a work-live space in Pilsen, and I'm building a podcast studio there. And I'm pretty close to, it's not 100% there yet, but it's pretty close to like coming together. Shure Microphones, shout out Shure Microphones. Shure is helping sponsor it,
yeah,
which I am so incredibly thankful for, because I genuinely
love Shure.
That's
actually a tough, they're a difficult get.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate. They're a hometown company. I use Shure products before I had any relationship with them.
They really are just kind of the best.
Yeah. They are. In the near future, this summer, the podcast studio will open, which is exciting. I think it's going to be really cool. And like I said, that'll launch sometime later this summer. I'm hoping July.
Let's talk about movies a little bit.
Sure, sure. This absolutely.
Cinema Jaw.
When I go to South by Southwest, I cover the film and interactive part.
Yeah.
And I have this badge.
I'm jealous of. That's awesome.
It is really cool. I love it. But I have a badge that lets me go to everything. So like, I just always go to film at night, and that's when all the horror films play.
Yeah, see, I saw your eyes light up when we were doing notes outside, and you started talking about horror.
Right, and so, incidentally, because they show all the horror movies at South by, all the, like, cool indie horror at midnight.
Yeah, right.
And what when I first started going to the films, because I had the badge, it was just to, like, chill out at the end of the night.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I was like, oh my god, these films are amazing. So, in the last few years, as independent film has gotten just really great, as like studios like A24 and Neon, like those guys have brought someone like me who had a passing familiarity with film into becoming more passionate about newer indie stuff. But
they're doing high quality stuff.
They are doing great stuff, but I would never be like, I know more about movies than anybody, because
so
I don't.
What'd you catch at South by this year?
I actually did not go for the full 9 days. I was only there a couple days, so I don't think I saw a lot of film. But in the past, I've seen, you know, Spring Breakers, The Invitation, Lords of Salem by Rob Zombie, all these films that I really ended up liking. I think I missed Green Room at South by, but I know it was one of the South by offerings.
Yeah, and I missed such a punk rock movie.
Oh,
too,
I
man.
Love Green Room. Like, and this year I was so bummed because I arrived the day after Hereditary.
Oh man.
And I wanted to see Hereditary.
Have you caught
so
up yet?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And high quality, right?
Oh my god.
I think we both gave it 4 Jaws here.
I don't want to spoil the film.
Right.
I watch a lot of horror. That is the primary genre that I consume. And I was reading interviews where they basically said this much without spoiling anything, that a lot of horror is very safe. You know, people are going to survive. Like maybe one person dies. Like,
sure.
But you know, there's going to be a happy-ish ending, or there's a jump scare at the end to like let you know, like, oh, the ghost isn't dead.
Right. The survivor girl wins and the villain dies. Yeah.
It's pretty like formulaic, which, you know, a lot of things are. And the interviews around Hereditary, and I would say this is true, is that Hereditary is not formulaic and they do not play it safe. And I won't say anything about it, but they make it pretty clear at a certain point in the movie that like all bets are off and you're like, oh.
I teased this earlier, but I do want to talk about what the hell we're doing in this fish tank in the middle of the bar at the Moxie Hotel in downtown Chicago. So you want to take us through what the Sound Off series is?
Yeah. So the idea, and I should state, first off, this was not the concept I came up with. I don't want anyone to think I'm taking credit.
Sure, sure. You're one of the people helping out.
Right. I'm helping out with this concept. And the idea is that Moxie, which is a new hotel in River North, like I said, LaSalle and Grand, you can just walk right in. It's got a great bar. It's got a taco bar. It's a hotel that's very walk-in friendly. They want this to be an atmospheric hangout in the neighborhood. So I heard kind of early on mutterings that there was going to be a podcast booth in a hotel. And I've done work with some different hotel brands over the years. I really like doing that. And so when I heard that there was a hotel brand in Chicago that was going to do podcast work, I was just like, me. So I sent them an email and I was like, hey,
well done, sir.
I would love to help out. You know, it's one of those things where I was like, this is a cool project if I can get into it. Long story short, I started talking to Moxie and they told me that they have a podcast booth, which they built out a mobile podcast booth. You can
like
move it around
right now.
We're sitting on it. It has wheels, so you can move this to different parts of the lobby. And the basic idea is that they want to have podcasters come in here and record, and whether that recording is going out over the speakers and people in the audience in the lobby can listen,
right.
Or if a podcaster is just in town and wants to record in the booth, they can do that too. But this is supposed to be a resource for podcasters and, you know, part of their programming and entertainment here at the hotel as well. So I just think it's a really exciting thing. I'm excited to be involved. I'm helping them identify some podcasters to bring in. You guys were, you know, Cinnamon Jaw was the first one that I booked myself.
Thank
and it's
you. Honored.
Yeah, man, it's exciting. So I just am very excited, and I feel lucky to be involved with this project because it's a very cool thing, and I think it's just going to grow.
For sure. And speaking of hotels, that is the topic of our top five this week. We're going to do top five hotel movies. I have a list. Haima has a list.
Yeah.
Since you're the guest, why don't you get us started with your number five?
Sure. So these are in a rough order.
Sure.
I think my number five is The Hangover. And I'll say this. I don't really necessarily love the first Hangover.
Okay.
I don't hate it. But it didn't land for me the way that everybody else loved it. I thought it was like, okay.
It's got a bit of a bro reputation.
It's very bro-y.
Yeah.
But then, and this is the weird thing, I know this is less hotel-y, I really liked The Hangover 2, which no one else liked. I think I liked it because it was much darker and a little bit meaner.
That's interesting.
Yeah, the Hangover 2 I could rewatch again. I think I'd be bored watching Hangover. But The Hangover is a cool hotel movie in that they have just this incredible view of Vegas. And even Hangover 3, they do return to Vegas and they
there
have some really...
Three?
Yeah, there
oh
was.
Oh, my God.
And I don't know why I've seen a trilogy of films I don't even like that much, but there you go. But they do have some great scenes of hotels in the first and third installments and like really cool angles on top of like, you know, some of the incredible hotels of Las Vegas and
right.
some different views. So I will say that even though I'm not like the biggest fan of the storyline, just from a like kind of hotel porn perspective and
sure.
like seeing this amazing view of Vegas and things like that, I do dig that component of The Hangover films.
You got to pay extra for the hotel porn.
Totally. Exactly.
I think it's a bit of a touchstone, right? I mean, there's
people love it.
People do love it. There's comedy before The Hangover and after. And plus, it's relatable because, like, who hasn't had that experience where you're in Vegas and you lose track of time and debauchery and all kinds of
and
bad things
Ken
happen?
Ken Jeong comes out and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a lion in the restroom.
Sure. And then Mike Tyson's there. We've right. all been there.
Yeah. I mean, that's, like, kind of an average weekend in Vegas.
Right.
All right. That swings it around to my number five. And
mm-hmm.
speaking of Vegas, this is not a comedy. In fact, it is... a depressing, dark movie, but one that I always return to. There was a time when Nicolas Cage...
Oh my God, I know what you're going to talk about.
He was an amazing actor.
Yes.
You know, I just saw a movie with him this year, and I'm thinking, what the hell is he doing? I won't say the name of the movie, but it's
got... Well, he's in a new one about a hotel right. or motel.
A hotel? Really?
He's in a new one where he buys a motel or something, and it's super creepy and weird. I saw a trailer for it.
Okay.
But I don't
just
think
saw
that's
a
out.
Cop movie with him, and it was
okay.
unbelievably bad.
The man gets work.
He gets work, but man, this was really bad. Like,
yeah.
I had to turn it off, and I'm usually good to go, even if a movie sucks.
Right.
But Leaving Las Vegas
yes.
did not suck.
No, Leaving Las Vegas, and I can't believe I've seen this one because it's so obscure, but it is like, that's a wild, depressing, weird, like
yeah.
unhinged, just like off the reins film.
Right. And it kind of answered the question, where the hell is Elizabeth Shue? You know, because she,
right.
she hadn't been doing anything for a while, and she pops up in this movie looking great and turning in a fantastic performance as his love interest. So Nicolas Cage is sort of basically drinking himself to death.
There's just like falling apart.
Yeah. Well, there's some mysterious thing in his past. He carries around a picture of a wife and kid that are absent from the film.
That part of his life is just over. So
right.
now he's in the aftermath of it.
They flash back to him losing his job, but they never do explain what happened to his wife and kid. So did they die somehow horribly? We don't know. But whatever it is,
yeah.
he doesn't want to go on. He's resolved to drinking himself to death in Las Vegas, which he has the money to do. He meets this hooker, and they become friends and maybe even soulmates. But he says
living
to her,
out of motels.
Living out of motels. And he
yeah.
says to her right in the beginning of the relationship, you can't ask me to stop drinking. And I'm not going to spoil the rest of the film, but it's depressing. And
it is a depressing film, and it's really like unhinged.
It's really good. It is
yeah.
really, really good. So what have you got at number four?
So number four, very similar in tone to Leaving Las Vegas in terms of just how depressing and how adult the themes are, is Home Alone 2.
Okay.
The
most depressing thing is Donald Trump's cameo.
I know, Donald Trump is in that film. And I haven't seen Home Alone 2 in a long time, but Home Alone 2, definitely like a hotel film, but it's kind of like one of these kind of dream scenarios other than like, you know, robbers trying to kill you and you being like 10 years old in New York. But it's like, you know, Kevin McAllister is just like living out of like, what is it, like the Ritz-Carlton or one of those?
Yeah.
Like just like some luxury hotel and still scamming people into thinking that this 10-year-old or whatever is just like adult accompanied and can order whatever he wants. So
right.
That's the fun kind of scenario. I have a feeling like it's my generation's like Sweet Life of Zack and Cody, which I'm only guessing at because I've never seen the Sweet Life of Zack and Cody and I don't know what it's exactly about, but I know they live in a hotel.
Yeah.
And I assume it's awesome. So
yeah, S-U-I-T-E life. Right. Yeah. I've caught a couple episodes. I have young kids.
Yeah, there you go. But Home Alone 2, man, that's a classic.
It is a classic. You would imagine, though, right? Like, after the first movie, everybody said that Kevin McAllister's parents were the worst parents in the world. Because how do you go on vacation and leave behind your 9-year-old son or 8 or however old he was?
Right.
But then to do it again in New York? I mean, really, where the hell is the Department of Child Services at this point?
Yeah, I don't know.
It should be taken away from these people.
Yeah, and honestly, he seems like he's better off a lot of times without them.
Yeah.
He seems like it's just other than like these robbers. But if those guys stayed in jail, he'd be fine.
Right.
Like, he could just, like, divorce from his family and, like, be a ward of the state or whatever, and he'd be totally good.
Joe Pesci. I miss him.
Yeah.
All right. So that swings it around to my number 4. And speaking of actors who suck and also have turned in some good work, I think this might be the best entry in recent years in the career of Adam Sandler.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going with the animated film Hotel Transylvania.
Oh, I've heard the title. I think it's a kid's movie, right?
Yeah, there's 2 of them now. But okay. I'm only vouching for the first one. It was kind of an original concept. You're into horror. I think you might.
I do. Yeah. I love horror.
You might like this. So Dracula runs a hotel. Frankenstein's monster is the bellhop. He's got a mummy. He's got a wolfman. They're all here. And the premise of the film is that there are real monsters in the world, and they need a place to stay when they're traveling.
Sure.
And, of course, they don't mix with humans, so they stay at the Hotel Transylvania. Wouldn't you know it, Drac has a young daughter who's coming of age. I guess she's maybe turning 20, something like that. She meets a human boy.
Right.
They fall in love and wackiness ensues. It's kind of like kids' monster version of Look Who's Coming to Dinner, I guess.
Okay. It's nice.
Yeah. Obviously, the two cultures do not mix between the humans and the monsters, but
right.
It's cute. The animation is really, really good. And Adam Sandler is actually really good in this role.
Adam Sandler can be great when he wants to be. I mean, you look at Punch, and I know everybody points to Punch Drunk Love, but you look at Punch Drunk Love and it's like, holy shit, he's great in Punch Drunk Love. So
did you catch the Meyerowitz stories last year?
No, what is that?
Okay, so he did this film. It was him, Dustin Hoffman, and Ben Stiller, among others. It was a great cast. And basically this dad is this crazy artist who's getting together a show. It's like a retrospective on all his work, and Dustin Hoffman is the dad, and he's totally like self-absorbed.
Huh.
It's and Adam again, he turns in this understated, like really well acted.
Well, yeah, I love that Adam Sandler. Like, and like I like fun, you know, Adam Sandler too, but it's like, you know, some of those movies are not very good in the current. Right. But when he wants to be good, when he's like that Adam Sandler, like, yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah. People dismiss him, but I think, you know, like you said, when he's not trying to do, I really wanted Pixels to work. And it didn't.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
Yeah, you're not missing anything. All right, so what have you got sitting there?
So number 3, I think we're at, is for me 1408, which is a John Cusack horror film. Yes. It's John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson. And it's maybe from like 2007-ish.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, post High Fidelity, post, you know, a lot of his like the big tentpole stuff we think of for John Cusack. And I love John Cusack. You know, he's a righteous warrior on Twitter. He's not afraid to speak up. And then High Fidelity is just a classic Chicago film.
Yeah.
So actually, this is...
I just lost a debate between me and Rye, which is more quintessentially Chicago, High Fidelity or Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
I mean, there's not a right or a wrong in that, I feel like. They're both pretty Chicago. You know, I will say Ferris Bueller lives in the suburbs.
Yeah.
But...
That's fair.
But he spends his day off very downtown. But then, like, Rob Gordon in High Fidelity, like, he's just, like, embedded in the heart of Old Wicker Park. He lives in the city, you know.
Can I confess something to you?
Yeah.
I have never seen High Fidelity.
Really? Yes. And I know I'm not the guy to be like, what? Because there's a lot of stuff I haven't seen. But, man, High Fidelity is just, like, classic, essential viewing.
I got to catch up with it. I feel like I've seen it at this point because we've talked about it on the show so
much. Well, sure. It's in the conversation.
So many clips, but I've never, like, sat down beginning to end and watched High Fidelity.
Man, you really should. It's a classic.
Right.
And again, I say that as somebody who has a lot of gaps in my filmography that I need to catch up on and view. Yeah, but I will say High Fidelity. I just have a lot of love for that film.
All right, that swings it around to my number three. And I got another horror film here.
Yeah.
And this is maybe a bit of a cheat. I guess if we're being hotel purists, somebody can make an argument that this isn't a hotel movie. It's a motel movie. But you
same thing. Same diff.
Yeah. And honestly, I think people could have this at number one. But I am going with Psycho.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about the original Alfred Hitchcock version, of course. The remake with Vince Vaughn and Anne Heche. It's pretty good. It's a shot-for-shot remake.
Yeah.
But you can't touch. I don't even know why you would. Why would you try to remake a Hitchcock film?
You're going up against big odds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this sort of launched the slasher genre of film. Where does this... This is one that must be close to your heart.
Well, yeah. And I was saying that I've never seen Psycho, which is crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So I need to...
Did we talk about that before?
Yeah.
Okay, you did mention that.
Yeah. But I do need to see Psycho. And again, like... I just didn't grow up watching films, which is not like an excuse, but it's more like
it's okay.
There's a lot of early stuff that I just have not actually consumed yet. And like you were saying about High Fidelity, it's like there's a certain caliber of films where they're so acclaimed that like they've kind of been, for lack of a better term, just Family Guide to death.
Right.
Where it's like if you haven't seen them, they've been on South Park or Family Guy or like just on SNL or like just referenced in articles. And it's like you just kind of osmosis these films
right,
and the you zeitgeist. Piece them together right because they're just so I haven't really seen the Star Wars films but if I sat down and watched them I wouldn't be like oh, Darth Vader's his father I would that would not be like a surprise that Darth Vader's his father
right,
like,
right
that's
right.
Pretty out in the world.
I tell you what, I'll go home after this podcast and watch High Fidelity
and I need to watch Psycho.
You need to watch Psycho.
Yeah,
or The Birds, take your pick.
Yeah, I mean
have you seen The Birds?
No, I haven't okay. seen any Hitchcock, so I need to do that.
Yes. Yeah
because I do love horror.
Well, you'll find out when you watch, especially Psycho, if you're into slasher horror at all.
I dig all kinds of horror.
Okay. So you'll kind of see, I guess, like, it's the shoulders of giants. Like,
well, I'm sure that that's where everything came from, 100%. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, he gave birth to the slasher genre. And to this day, like, I'll rewatch the shower scene, which you could totally catch on YouTube.
Right.
And just the sound, the angles. I mean, it's obviously, like, an iconic moment in film at this point.
Right.
You've probably seen it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That I mean, that much I've seen.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And the shower scene... just still blows my mind. But the way the whole film fits together, dude. Yeah.
Yeah, I need to watch that.
Yeah, for sure. But I'm not going to harp on it because I haven't seen High Fidelity.
Yeah, but we both have homework.
Yes, we do. That swings it around to your number two.
Yeah, so my number two is a film that we were just talking about, A24, and it's an A24 film that I saw in the last few months and I just fell in love with, and I know everyone fell in love with it because it's a great film, and that is The Florida Project.
Yes.
And it's just such a... just like incredible film about, you know, a couple different families, you know, who are living out of this motel in Florida, and the kids are all sort of like, they're not teens, they're, you know, I don't know, maybe
grammar school age,
grammar like school, seven, yeah, eight. Like five, like 6 to like 9 years old, somewhere in that window, 7 to mm-hmm. 9 years old, I guess. And so like they're not like teens yet, they're not really mature,
their kind of like problems are very understandable,
yeah, and they don't really like fully understand the scope of the world yet, and they're living in this motel which is surrounded by very like very mature adult scenarios where like there's a lot of real problems happening here and there's a lot of people who are dealing with real issues that are very adult and very like mature, and these poor kids, well, I don't even want to say poor kids, it's like they're the kids who live in this motel and who have found kind of a family in each other, they kind of have a vague awareness of what's going on, but not fully. So they still have like a level of childhood innocence with, it seems like a vague sense that like something might be a little bit off. But I love Florida Project, and that's, again, a motel film, not a hotel film, but it's a great
close enough
film about, you know, just these communities and the struggles these people are going through and what their lives look like. And it's just so well done.
Yeah, I agree, man. So Sean Baker, the filmmaker,
yeah,
also did Tangerine the year before.
And that's one I need to see and I haven't seen and I want to.
You should. It's basically like the Clerks of the transgender community.
And of making a film on your iPhone, too,
right,
from what I've heard. Yeah.
Honestly, that is almost an aside. It was like a headline in their press release to get attention for the film.
Sure.
It stands on its own merits 100%. And it is so kinetic and amazing. The Florida Project is just like even a step above that. Like the performance that Willem Dafoe turns in that film is just I don't know, man. Second, yeah,
it's untouchable.
But I got a crazy theory about this movie, and I want to run it by you.
Okay.
So I basically think that the hotel or motel is purgatory, and Willem Dafoe's character is God. And a lot of people think I'm nuts for this, but like, if you think about it, like, there are some scenes where he's like almost to the point of like, let there be light, when he's fixing the lights and everything.
Right.
You know,
and he does like. He's definitely the person who's making things happen for those people.
Right.
Yeah, I can see that.
He's so kind, and he's just like looking out for them. I don't know. Maybe it's an allegory. Maybe it wasn't intentional, but I...
No, but I could definitely see that argument.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right. So that swings it around to my number two. And maybe this seems like a letdown after Psycho, and I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of shit for this, but I really love the movie Four Rooms.
Yes, that's another good one, and I almost put that on my list, but I haven't seen it in so long. I haven't seen it since it was like a VHS that I rented, but I was like, I'm not going to remember enough about this film to speak about it at any length. But I remember it being a great film, and it's four individual stories, and yeah.
That's what I like most about it, is the premise of the film is so original, and they basically made four short films, right? Each one was directed by a different director. The common thread is the bellhop who goes through each room. He also meets an interesting fate at one point in the film, but it's kind of like an anthology movie.
Right, it is.
And even if you don't like any one of the particular stories, one of them is going to turn you on. And I think Tarantino's is a real standout.
Yeah, I need to go back and rewatch that because it's been years and years and years. Like I said, like I rented that as a VHS, if it gives you an idea of how long it's been since I've seen that film. But it is a really great film. I remember enjoying that a lot.
95 is the year. And that's, dude, so that caught us at a tender young age.
So that was 23 years ago. Yeah. So I'm not making it up that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Time for a revisit. All right. So here we are, our number ones. What is your favorite hotel movie?
Yeah, you know, and like, I don't even know if this is like number one of all time for me, but on the list that I was looking at, I was like, yeah, this is a good one. I love Hostel. I love the horror films. Yeah. And Hostel, it's definitely grisly. It's definitely bloody. It's definitely gory. But I love the idea that these stupid, like, meathead bros are traveling and they get seduced into going to this torture. Have you seen Hostel?
Oh, yes.
Okay, yeah. So they get seduced into going to this, like, torture castle, like, torture, like, factory warehouse in the middle of...
It's torture for sale.
It's torture for sale, yes. And there was something about that concept of, like, these, like, idiot dudes just basically getting sold into torture that, like, the horror film in me, I was like, that's kind of novel. Like, I felt like I hadn't seen that before. And then they made two other ones, and, you know, that's what happens with horror. But when the first one came out, I was like, okay. This is like, it was like the first Saw and the first Hostel were like fun original concepts, and then like there are a million imitators, but those two, like, the ideas were unique, and I love the first Hostel film. I think it's a lot of fun, and I think it's very, I mean, it's a good time for us watching. It's not a good time for them, but
ew.
Yeah, but I did like the con. I think I just really liked the concept of the Elite Hunting, which is the organization that facilitates that. I thought that was a cool thing that they could have, like, I felt like they could have built a world around that. Like,
well,
if
they
this
sort
movie,
of did, right?
They sort subsequent- of did, but like, I feel like if Hostel came out today, there would have been like a cinematic universe of like Elite Hunting, just like how they're doing that
with The Purge.
Right. Like they're doing The Purge. But you know what we should have put in here was like John Wick, which has that hotel. But now they're doing a film or TV show or something about the hotel in the world of John Wick, which I just feel like if Hostel came out today, there would have been like Hostel 2 and then maybe like the Elite Hunting or whatever film.
Yeah. You know? So the thing about Hostel is it's divisive, right? Like, you either love the movie or hate it. I don't think people kind of are lukewarm about Hostel.
No, nobody's just like, watched it with my grandma, it was fine.
Right.
No one says that.
It's definitely also sort of it's a touchstone. Like, you can point to Hostel as being, and I guess Saw too, to some degree, but really the term torture porn, for better or for worse.
Yeah, Hostel and Saw.
Yeah.
Like, that was that moment, that's when that happened. Especially like after the first Saw, because the first Saw wasn't even near as graphic as I think people wanted to attribute it to.
Not really.
But like once the sequel machine started for that and, you know, Hostel came out and then like there were a lot of imitators, suddenly everyone's like, it's torture porn. But like that first Saw, they're just chilling in a bathroom for like 90 minutes.
It's almost more of a mystery.
It is a mystery. And then like the first Saw was really the only time in the Saw franchise where like it was just two guys for the whole film for a 90-minute trap.
Yeah.
Because every film after that, it was like 19 traps, each of which Jigsaw's like, you have 30 seconds. And like, you know, the guys in Saw 1 got like, you know, in that film, they had hours.
They had the whole day, and right. Jigsaw was there on the floor.
Right, like, spoiler, he didn't do alert. That. They got, like, the VIP treatment on that one.
They really did.
Nobody else got that level of engagement.
It was sort of his coup de grace, his grand moment.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, the Hostel, the first one is my number one.
All right, that swings it around to my number one, and I'm sticking with horror.
Yeah.
When you talk about hotels, there is one filmmaker who captured the ominous nature that can be present in especially like really old hotels.
Really big hotels, yeah.
And I'm talking about the Overlook Hotel in Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Sure, yeah. It's a no-brainer.
It's totally a no-brainer. It's
probably... Even I've seen that one.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Have you seen the movie? They actually made a documentary.
I know you're going to ask, and I have not. The documentary about mm-hmm. The Shining.
Yeah, I think it's called Room 231.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a room number in that was used in... That's where the zombie came out of the bathtub.
Okay.
Like where all the hauntings came from was this one room, or at least a big part of the haunting. That is a fascinating documentary.
I need to watch that one.
At one point in the movie, they put The Shining against itself back to back. So you're watching the end overlaid over the beginning, and the whole movie plays in both directions until you reach the middle point, and then it passes itself, if that makes sense.
Weird. No, it does. That's interesting.
So, and these conspiracy theorists, and the documentary goes through like four different conspiracy theories. Like there's one about how the symbols in the carpet have to do with like Native American traditions, and it gets into some really far-fetched
stuff. I hear there's like moon landing stuff.
Yeah,
like
totally.
Yeah.
Kubrick was accused of faking the moon landing, or if anyone can do it, it was probably him, right? But the watching the film back-to-back, because they say that it mirrors itself, and I think that one, if any of them, has a little bit of truth to it, because Kubrick was such a great filmmaker.
Right.
He understood like how to compose a movie where there are beats and reflections upon itself.
Symbolism, yeah.
Right, so... I encourage you, even if you are a big fan of The Shining, if you haven't seen this documentary,
I need to watch the doc. And it's been a couple of years since I've seen The Shining last, so I should rewatch that, because The Shining is a classic and it is terrifying, and it is also just like gorgeous hotel footage too.
Yeah.
Like just from a purely aesthetic standpoint, but it's again completely terrifying. It's just such a nightmare scenario where it's like, what do you do if you're just all alone there and you're like a little kid and your dad goes insane in this enormous building and there's no one to help you?
Yeah, like, except for Shelley Duvall.
Right. And then I'm interested to see what they do with the sequel that they're doing now.
Oh, no. They're doing a sequel?
Well, no, but they're doing a sequel, but it's from... Do you know the book?
Yeah, Mr.
Dr. Sleep or whatever.
Dr. Sleep, yeah.
They're doing that. So like he's all grown up. The kid's all grown up. Danny is all grown up. And he's using his power. I don't even know the full plot of the book, so I shouldn't stumble as if I do. But it's basically like, I guess what I'll say from what I understand, it's not like, oh, they're going back to the hotel and it's part two. It's like a totally different.
Right.
I think it's like a...
My wife's read it. She's a huge King fan. I just haven't read the book yet.
Yeah, but it's not like Shining 2. They're back at the Overlook.
Right.
You know, it's going to be like a different thing in that world. Kind of like how House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects are like very different films.
Spiritual sequel.
Right. Like it's the same characters and the same story, but it's like, boy, those take place in two different genres.
Yeah. Almost like, yeah, it's very, very much so. All right. What about honorables? Got anything?
Man, I kind of wish we had mentioned the John Wick films in that list. So, well, yeah, like now, and I haven't seen the second John Wick, but like
it's good.
That first one.
It's good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first one's a blast and that hotel is so cool. Like, it's so cool. Like that's a hotel that I would totally love to like go visit, but I'm not cool enough by any stretch.
Holiday Inn? I mean, it's a cheesy old Bing
Never
Crosby.
Seen it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. It's worth checking out. Some Like It Hot, Marilyn Monroe.
Okay.
Okay. I saw this when I was a kid. That's why I didn't throw it on the list.
Sure.
And I think we would be remiss if we did not at least mention the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah. And that's another one that I haven't seen, but I know is supposed to be great that I need to watch.
Yeah. No doubt about it.
There's a lot of great hotel movies. And as somebody who digs hotels and works at a few different hotels, I should really do my homework with some of these.
Yeah, no doubt, man. And I need to watch High Fidelity.
Yeah, that's just a classic Chicago movie. You know, but I've never seen Blues Brothers, so we both have a blind spot in our Chicago classic filmography, you know, catalog.
All right, I can't give you too much crap, but dude, yeah.
I know I need to see Blues Brothers.
Yeah, well, yeah. And I need to see High Fidelity.
Right.
So I guess that's just about a wrap. We have
Sorry.
Oh,
if
no,
I
no.
can jump in with one more.
Yeah.
Because I saw this when I was like researching this list. One more that deserves an honorable mention is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
True. Yeah. They
that's
go to
a great,
bunch of
like,
different hotels.
They go to a bunch of different hotels, and it's obviously just a nightmare trip for both of them. But I mean, anyone listening to this podcast, we don't need to tell them why that movie's great, but that movie's great.
Absolutely, man. Well done.
Yeah.
All right, Jawheads, if we miss your favorite hotel movie, shoot us a tweet or write us at feedback@cinemajaw. Let us know what we missed. We always retweet and answer every email, so thanks for that. And we'll be right back with more in a minute.
Nice list, Matt.
Oh, hey, thanks, dude.
How cool was that doing it at the Moxie?
It was really neat. I like that place a lot. And those tacos are awesome.
I got to get over there. It's on my bike route coming from the AMC where we see the screenings all the time.
Oh, yeah?
It must be on Ontario or Grand.
It's on Grand, yeah.
Grand, okay. So I actually do bike past it quite a bit. I'm like, oh, that's where Matt Kay was doing the podcast.
Hey, do yourself a favor. Seriously, pop in for a beer and a taco. You will thank yourself. It's amazing.
All right. I said at the top of the show that I wanted to do my number one hotel movie, but after listening to your lists...
Oh, you got inspired.
I just got inspired, and I'm just going to go rapid fire really quick. My number five, have you seen 1408, the movie with, I believe it's Samuel L. Jackson and John Cusack?
Yeah.
Horror movie, right? Mm-hmm. Also, hotel movie, when you think about it, Pretty Woman.
Okay.
All right. Lost in Translation.
Good one.
Yeah. 2004, my number two pick would be Hotel Rwanda.
That's a good one.
Right?
Yeah.
That is an excellent movie. And my number one, come on. Wes Anderson made a hotel movie, the greatest hotel movie of all time, The Grand Budapest Hotel. I'm going to bring in the Blu-ray next week for you.
All right. If you lend me the Blu-ray, I will watch it.
It's awesome.
Okay.
So, we are in. All right, Matt. So you were sent a copy of a movie here.
Occasionally, we get the opportunity to review some lesser-seen films, independent films, and sometimes you get some real hidden gems. The post-hardcore scene in Los Angeles during the early 2000s were some of the last gasps of the old guard of the rock and roll machine. Today, in the digital era, everything has changed, but many of those artists are still alive, still making great music, still trying just make it all work somehow. The Icarus Line's Joe Cardamone embodies this in the new film ominously titled The Icarus Line Must Die. Here we see the creative result of charismatic frontman Joe Cardamone's collaboration with filmmaker Michael Grodner, and the sum is far greater than its parts. The real band, The Icarus Line, is well known for its destructive behavior, but right from the opening of the movie, I was shocked at how down-to-earth and, dare I say it, responsible Joe's character is. He's a hustler, an artist, and a business person, dealing thoughtfully with realistic relationships, and he comes across as earnest and likable. I was not expecting that. There's a theme of growing up here. In Icarus Line Must Die, punk's not dead. It just has bills to pay. Speaking of punk, Keith Morris of Circle Jerks and Black Flag fame pops up as himself in the picture, which adds some mostly unneeded street cred. I say unneeded because the movie was, you know, going along just fine, but it was great to see him and hearing him lament about turning 60 and embarking on a book tour. In fact, many of the LA scene members and underground artists appear and perform in the movie, like Ariel Pink, Pearl Charles, just to name a couple. In the end, when the other shoe finally drops in this slow burn, you'll see just how punk this collaboration truly is. With this, his first feature, Michael Grodner is clearly influenced by the late 70s, early 80s no-wave cinema from New York. But Icarus Line Must Die is very LA, and that's what sets it apart. While it's fair to call it a loosely scripted series of vignettes based on actual events, there's a dark through line of texted death threats to Joe that gives this a wonderful LA noir mystery feel. Who did Joe piss off, and are these threats to be taken seriously? Why does Joe keep ducking calls of the manager of the cult? I was hooked on trying to solve the puzzle. The pressures and stresses of everyday life are mounting for Joe, and the viewer is taken into his psyche via some nightmare sequences that have us questioning whether or not he's coming apart at the seams. Add to this the stylistic choice of black and white cinematography and some amazing driving shots, classic LA noir stuff, and this is one detective away from being a hard-boiled thriller. And I was expecting a rock biopic, which it also sort of is. This movie is mysterious and honest, LA and New York, brash and mature, punk rock for grown-ups. It will leave you with a deeper knowledge of and thirst for underground music. This is very worth your time.
Wow. I'm excited for this one. You mentioned right at the top there that we get a chance to review some of these lesser-known films that we'll get links to and whatnot. And I had saw this one and wasn't sure what to make of it, other than, boy, this is right up Matt Kay's alley.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, I mean, anytime like Keith Morris pops up in a movie, honestly, there's only one other movie you can kind of come up with off the top of your head, which is Repo Man by Alex Cox, which is, you know, obviously one of my favorite movies of all time.
How's the music in this one?
Oh, it's great. In fact, most of the music is performed live in this movie. These are underground artists, a lot of which, I'll be completely honest, I'd never heard of before. But some of it is just like, wow, I really lost track of what's going on in punk rock. It's just stuff that just blew my mind. It's not what you would expect. It's artistic and different and cool. It's really good music.
Oh, I'm excited for it. And the performance is all pretty good, huh?
Yeah, the performances are pretty. I mean, are you saying the acting or the music?
The acting.
Yeah, yeah. Especially Joe. I mean, he's sort of the central character. And he struts around, man. He's got this Sid Vicious meets James Dean sort of thing going on. And he's just cool. He just like kind of oozes cool in this movie.
Sounds really good. How many Jaws you giving this one?
This movie, like you mentioned, is sort of geared toward me. So I'm giving it 4 Jaws. Somebody not interested in underground music, I can understand if they gave it a slightly lower score, but I really enjoyed it. And if you're into indie art house, especially if you like the no wave stuff from New York in the 80s, late 70s, I think you'll really find this interesting.
I'm going to have to give this one a spin.
You should. Yeah, definitely, dude.
4 Jaws from Matt Kay. All right, how about this? Let's take a break. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we are going to play your interview with the writer, director, and star of The Icarus Line Must Die.
Very cool.
All right, we'll be right back on Cinema Jaw.
Good tease.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to
Hello, Jawheads. First, we want to say thank you for listening all the time and sharing your passion for the movies. Putting on a podcast every week does require help and support. The easiest way you can help us is through Patreon.
Patreon is a crowdfunding platform that helps support creative endeavors such as CinemaJaw. You can think of it as Kickstarter, but instead of a one-time contribution, you select an amount to give each month. That amount is up to you and what you feel comfortable with.
To thank you for your support, we have fun gifts and perks to shower you with. CinemaJaw flasks, shirts, or even hearing yourself on the show. The best part is, all patrons, no matter the tier, will get exclusive access to bonus CinemaJaw content. No matter the amount, we are thankful for the support.
If you would like to become a CinemaJaw patron, and we hope you do, please visit patreon.com/CinemaJaw, or you can visit cinemajaw.com and click on Support the Show on the upper right-hand side.
We couldn't or wouldn't want to do this show without you. Thank you for all your support.
Hey Jawheads, it's Matt Kay with a quick reminder of this month's riddle. Here we go. I have rolled with an ocean and eaten pizza with a cat. I fell in love with the same man twice. The first may have been the best moment of my career. The second, I couldn't run away from fast enough. I am the voice of a spider and the giver of bad fruit. There are 3 things I am known to do, the last of which is love. Who am I? So write us with your response at feedback@cinemajaw.com, and one lucky winner will get a cool prize from CinemaJaw. And thanks.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
And we're back on CinemaJaw. Matt, it's interesting, as you just got done reviewing the film, The Icarus Line Must Die.
Mm.
You also had a chance to talk to the writer, director, and star of this film.
Yeah, I did. Very, very fortunate to talk to these guys. And I think Michael Grodner will have to have on as a full guest. I'd love to have them both on if they have the time. So just to set this up a little bit, the audio with Michael wasn't the best. I guess I must have had the recorder too close to my cheap monitor at home and it was picking up some static or something. But the interview with Joe sounds great. So here we go. This is Matt Kay from CinemaJaw, and I am here with Michael Grodner, filmmaker of Icarus Line Must Die. And I want to get started kind of with what got you started, Michael.
Worked a bunch in music videos. I kind of got involved with music videos just as the music industry was kind of falling off a cliff. So
right.
The budgets for these music videos would just shrunk and shrunk. You're always in the back of your head when you're doing music videos. You know, the end goal in a way is making films, making a feature. So once the budget's really shriveled up, I decide to really go for it and make films.
Did Dirty Laundry come before or after you started making films? And can you tell us about Dirty Laundry?
Yeah, Dirty Laundry TV is a web series that I started about 9 years ago, where we interview bands in a laundromat while they do their laundry. And we've had over 200 bands come through over the last several years, all from, let's say, Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth to Mudhoney to Atari Teenage Riot, Ariel Pink. We had the Slits in. Plus, we have a lot of newer bands and local bands from, say, Los Angeles or the area around here, like Plague Vendoring last year. We had Foxygen. So, yeah, lots of bands. And how that got started was when I decided to stop doing music videos and focus on putting together a feature and raising money for a feature on my own. And I wanted to put all my efforts into that, making that film or putting together money for that film. So I thought, but I wanted to stay in touch with the music scene and the musicians. So I thought, well, this Dirty Laundry idea, which I came up with on a lark, it seemed like, you know, pretty low impact. I could just shoot it with a, you know, do very kind of lo-fi, have a cameraman, a sound person, a host, and just kind of stay in touch with the music world. And it kind of took on a life of its own.
That's awesome.
And it kind of was, it became sort of the, basically what led to the Icarus Line Must Die.
All right. Well, that's a perfect segue, actually. What did give you the idea for Icarus Line Must Die? Where did it come from?
Well, we had interviewed Joe Cardamone from the Icarus Line twice on Dirty Laundry. We did one cruise episode, and actually both of these, I believe, are on YouTube, so your audience could check it out. Yeah, so I became familiar with Joe, and we became friendly, and we had just talked about over the years wanting to do something together, work-wise. We didn't know exactly what we were what we wanted to do. I brought in a partner who is a producer, editor. His name's Josh Crockett. As a matter of fact, he just edited, you know, since the Christmas, he edited this movie Tag, which just came out.
Oh, sure.
But he was my partner on this picture. On the Icarus Line, I said to him, hey, I want to make this film, and do you want to come in with me? And we're both, he's edited for me in the past, he's edited music videos for me, and we have very similar musical tastes, and you know, I really trust him. You know, and I wanted to make a film literally right now. Like, if I said tomorrow I want to make a film, how do I do that? Figured, how do you make a movie with very little money, but still make something good that the lack of funds actually works in your favor? I thought about the films of the sort of the No Wave era of filmmakers, the No Wave movement of the late 70s, early 80s, the Lower East Side, where filmmakers were making films on the street, casting their friends, maybe other musicians. It was very tied into sort of the punk scene and the CBGB's scene.
Oh, yeah.
So you had filmmakers like Jim Jarmusch or Amos Poe or Beth and Scott B and Nick Zedd to a certain degree. They were making these films, and they had this really raw aesthetic, and it was kind of punk rock filmmaking. And I thought, wow, you know, they were able to make these films for very little money. They were able to, you know, utilize the resources they had. What happens if I did that in Los Angeles? Both Joe and I, you know, we know a lot of bands, we know a lot of musicians. Maybe we can pool our resources and make sort of a rock and roll film or punk rock film in LA. Yeah, that's how it kind of got started.
I was going to ask you about the collaboration with Joe Cardamone and exactly what parts or what elements did he bring to the table? Because I know he was pretty heavily involved.
Yeah, Joe was very heavily involved. You know, like I said, we have talked about working together. And I thought when I wanted to make this film or I thought about this film, I thought he would be a perfect subject or a perfect center for the film. And I thought, you know, I can make a movie. We can use a lot of great performance, music performance in the movie. It could be, like I said, like a rock and roll film. Like in a sense, how we haven't seen movies like that a lot recently, where you could actually see like really cool performance in a film with a story. I pitched it to Joe because I've always thought he's a really compelling figure. He's a great front man. He's one of the best front men I've ever seen. And he, and at the time, it would just seem to be the right move for him at the time, too. And his story, the story of the film, is a guy who is turning 36 years old. He's about to get married. He still has the Icarus Line. The Icarus Line were a band that in the early 2000s were signed to V2 Records. I think they were the last band signed to V2 Records. They toured the world. They toured with the Strokes. They, you know, there was definitely a, they built this kind of infamous reputation. But now 15 years later, he still has the band and he's still going strong, but it's on, you know, different members. It's just, how do you keep going when you're no longer a kid anymore and you've got a, you know, you're about to get married, you've got a house, you've got to pay mortgage, you've got to put food on the table, you want to stay true to yourself, you want to maintain your integrity, and you want to keep on putting out your art. But the music environment has changed. You know, rock and roll maybe is different, or rock music is different than it was then, you know, when bands like the White Stripes were getting signed, or the Strokes were getting signed. People aren't throwing money at bands like that anymore. I thought that's a really cool time in an artist's life. And what we did is I worked with Joe and took a lot of the stories from his life and his experiences and formulated this very detailed outline, not a proper script, but a detailed outline. And that's what we used to start making the film. The center of the movie is, a lot of it is shot at Joe's studio. Joe has a recording studio that he works at. I mean, Joe was also somewhat of an epicenter of music in L.A. He's good friends with Ariel Pink. I mean, we featured Ariel Pink on Dirty Laundry as well, but Joe, you know, works with him and knows him quite well. Keith Morris, who's in the film, first lead singer of Black Flag, Circle Jerks, Off, he was the assistant to the A&R guy at V2 Records back when Joe signed with them. So he's now in the film too. Again, we had shot with Keith for Dirty Laundry a couple of times as well. So, you know, we had similar crossover or overlap of people we knew. You know, having Joe in your corner definitely helped bring some of these people in.
So in addition to all the themes you just mentioned, there is like a layer in my review, I kind of called it a layer of LA noir to this story, where Joe keeps getting these text death threats to him. And it adds sort of this layer of mystery. Was that always part of the idea to add this additional layer to it? Or was that something that developed as you guys went along?
There was always the idea, and it's all based in fact. Joe has had a lot of different members of the Icarus Line. You know, there's somewhat of a darkness that surrounds his band, with members coming in and out and having difficulties, you know, maybe drugs and other situations. So there was a period of time when Joe was getting death threats, and death threats by text. In fact, some of the death threats that, you know, those texts that we use were the actual wording of some of these death threats that Joe was receiving, and he didn't know where he was getting it from, and it was very frightening for him and caused a great deal of anxiety. And this is, you know, something we thought we wanted to include in the film, because it's certainly, you know, it's another element that Joe experienced.
Yeah, I like it. It really ramps up the feeling of tension and kind of shows Joe, the stress gets heaped on this character, and it's a good build toward the ending. And you mentioned Jim Jarmusch. Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Jim Jarmusch earlier, and I was wondering if that was part of the decision-making or the inspiration for why you decided to go black and white, or was that more of a utilitarian decision?
Well, both. But yes, it's certainly part of the aesthetic of the film. Yeah, I mean, Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law are two movies that are big influences for me, and especially influences in this film. Well, there's a movie called The Foreigner by Amos Poe, which is also from that era, that was shot in black and white, which was also, an influence. I love black and white, too. I mean, I've shot a number of my music videos in black and white. I'm just a fan. You know, I love Raging Bull. I love I love, say, Manhattan or Broadway Danny Rose as well. I mean, some more modern films that were shot in black and white. But I do feel like the film has a darkness to it, and the storyline has a darkness. So it fits the tone of the characters and the storyline as well. And then again, hopefully gives somewhat of a timeless quality to it.
I think you succeeded, man. I like the way you play with the light and the shadow and some of your composition, not to get too film school-y here, but I really enjoyed, man. You have a very good eye, so well done.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
So we were kind of talking about this a little bit before we started recording about the release. The movie is currently sort of making the rounds in the festival circuit, and then it's going to theaters, and then soon afterward going to be released on digital. Can you tell us about the strategy, the release strategy, and when things are coming out?
Yes, we signed up with a distribution company called Dark Star Pictures, and they are giving us a limited theatrical release for the movie. By the time this airs, the movie will have premiered at the Regent Theater in Los Angeles, premiere on June 20th, and then on June 22nd, it opened in a theater in Los Angeles called The Royal. But then we're moving out nationwide. It should be opening in New York around the time that this airs, in the first couple of weeks of July. And then there after that, it will be at different theaters throughout the country that have not been earmarked just yet. But on July 10th, the movie opens digitally, so it will be on iTunes, Amazon, video on demand, as well as different streaming services.
Oh, that's awesome. We call our fans the Jawheads, and I do encourage all the Jawheads listening to seek this movie out, whether in the theater or especially in the theater if you can, but if not, certainly on Amazon or iTunes. So, Michael, what's coming down the pike next from you?
Yeah, I have a couple of films that I'd love to be the next films that I make. One is a movie called Beyond Apollo, which is based on a cult classic science fiction novel from the early 70s by Barry Malzberg. There's a horror picture I wrote called We Are Here. And then I'm also working on a documentary about another Los Angeles musician. His name is Rob Zabrecki, and he was in a band sort of, let's say, in the early 90s, mid-90s, called Possum Dixon. It's a wild ride, and it's a really interesting story.
Well, if people want to keep in touch with you, follow along with what you're doing, is there a good place to go on social media or the internet?
Yeah, well, on Facebook, we have The Icarus Lion Must Die. We have a Facebook page. On Twitter, we have The Icarus Line Movie, and then there's Dirty Laundry TV as well.
Okay.
On all your social medias.
Well, Michael Grodner, thank you for your time. Thanks for being on Cinema Jaw.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. So this is Matt from Cinema Jaw, and I am here with Joe Cardamone from The Icarus Line Must Die. Joe, how are you, man?
I'm okay. I'm all right today.
The Icarus Line Must Die. What did you find as far as being your first feature film acting experience, and what did you find most challenging about acting?
I mean, it was kind of a unique situation because I was not only playing myself, but we were almost reenacting moments from my life, or at least we were reenacting sort of distilled versions of moments in my life. So, you know, I guess the entire thing was a little bit surreal, but we were moving at such a fast pace that I just didn't really have time to dwell on how fucking awkward the thing was.
The movie sort of treats this right in the beginning. It opens up with you on a radio show, and the host of the radio show asks you about how your reputation squares with your character's persona. So, you know, the Icarus Line, the band, was sort of well known as being bad boys, but the character you play in the movie comes across as like very down to earth and even like responsible. So Which is closer?
Yeah.
Which is closer, I guess, to the real you, and how does that square up?
I guess like anyone, you know, we're all like dynamic beings. Both sides of the coin are good representations. You know, it's just I don't know, the home life and the life away from home can be very different because you're just thrown into situations that cause you to react, you know. So I basically, to make a long answer short, both things are true.
Okay. You mentioned that these events in the film are mostly, you know, from your real life, aside from the ending. And I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't seen it. It's got a very jarring, let's say, ending. So what, aside from that, what things in the movie aren't from your real life? Or was pretty much everything?
I'd rather not tell anyone.
Really?
You know?
Oh, that's interesting.
I feel like I feel like it's better if no one really knows what's real and what's fake.
That's cool. It is. It's fun to sort of try to suss that out, man. I agree with you. I like that answer.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about you and the collaboration with Michael Grodner.
I thought I was going to show up and, you know, it was going to be him and an iPhone. And, you know, I didn't know that we were actually, like, trying to make a movie, you know?
Yeah. Was it intimidating that first day when you walked in and you were like, oh, shit, there's, like, lights and camera people and all that?
People. I don't remember it being intimidating. It probably was, but I kind of just used it to quickly feel a focus. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, okay, so I have to, like, try to deliver some sort of performance here. It's weird because I've been surrounded by film and acting my whole life to some degree. You know, my sister went to Pepperdine for theater, and my dad was a child actor in the 60s, kind of like, you know, famous on TV well before I was born. And then by the time I was around, that was totally over. But it's always kind of been around, which kept me away from it because everyone else was dabbling in that.
Yeah.
You know, so I never really intended on doing anything like this with my life. But yeah, it was fun. Here's the thing. It was a challenge and it was scary, and that's why I did it, because it was like, okay, this is something that I'm not comfortable with. Let's do it.
You got to keep pushing yourself.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that begs the question, has this experience ignited the desire to do more in the acting space, or is it been there, done that?
No, it definitely was inspiring and kind of broke down how accessible filmmaking could be, because prior to this, it really just seemed like a giant headache that just was more trouble than it was worth. You know, when you see it from an outsider perspective, it's just, you know, the industry kind of is good at building a gate, you know, especially coming from Los Angeles or whatever. And it's definitely inspired us. I mean, we've already made another 40-minute film that complements the new music collection that I've released, and we're working on getting another feature off the ground.
That's great, man. Any details you can share, or is it all still coming together?
No, I mean, the 40-minute film is titled Holy War, just like the music collection, and I think that's coming out August 4th. Then there's another feature that, yeah, I probably shouldn't talk about it until it's, like, fully funded, but yeah, there's lots of stuff in the pipeline. We actually, after the film, me and my partners got a cool camera. We got, like, the Panasonic Barricam, and we have an edit bay and all kinds of stuff at the studio now, kind of turning the recording studio into a full-on production facility, audiovisual. It was very inspiring that way.
Jumping around a little bit back to sort of the experience of acting as a version of yourself, and a lot of these events, like we talked about, are from your real life. You sort of hinted at this, but I wanted to ask, was any of this, like, difficult to relive? Because, I mean, your character, and I didn't even know this, like, Michael sort of clued me in on the fact that even the death threats that the Joe in the movie starts getting are a version of something that really happened to you. But was anything...
Oh, yeah.
Was going through that again difficult? And if so, like, what was the most difficult thing to relive?
I think in the moment, the hardest part of the film was kind of like talking with Charlotte candidly about like financial woes and kind of putting that out there, you know, because it's just not my instinct to put like my personal business on Front Street at all. So that was like counterintuitive to me, but we got it done. I would say at the end of the day, you know, it was all a little more exposing than I'm comfortable with, but the thing that got me through it was I've been in the music scene here in Los Angeles for a long time. I'm a producer, so I produce a lot of records for people, and I see their lives. And at a certain point, I realized what I was doing was making a movie about all of us.
Yeah.
And that helped really kind of tune my perspective on it and took it away from me, you know, which made the whole thing kind of work in my mind.
What's going on with the Icarus line?
Yeah, the band is done. It's I'll never do that band again. Actually, you know, the version of the band that's in the film, besides the live performances, was really the death throes of the band and almost was put together for the film. Alvin, by the time we made the film, Alvin was already really struggling with cancer.
Yeah.
And since he became sick, the band was basically, you know, the band was on life support, just kind of, without him, it wasn't really worth doing it. And honestly, for the last, I don't know, 5-6 years of the group, part of my motivation for doing it was to be able to do something together.
I know you're working on some films and stuff, but musically, what's coming down the pipe?
About, I think, almost a month ago at this point, I released 8 new tracks. I guess you could call it solo material, you know, for lack of a better term. And it's a collection called Holy War, and there's a bunch more videos and music to come out from it. And that's kind of my main focus as far as music goes these days. It's just that project. It's just me.
Where can people get in touch with you, follow you online? Where's the best place to keep track of all things Joe Cardamone?
I guess just like wherever, you know, Google. Google my name if you care, and you'll find your way towards something.
Well, hey, man, I want to congratulate you on the premiere of the film and on the film in general. It's
thank you.
A really cool piece of independent filmmaking. And we'll be watching out for your next performances for sure.
Right on. Thanks for talking.
They sound like some pretty cool guys.
Yeah, very, very cool. It's a cool film, and it's a great story of how these two got together. And fascinating and interesting figures in the L.A. underground music and film scene.
So it sounds like people got to put the Icarus line must die on their cues. Keep an eye out for this one.
Right, yeah. So it's going to be premiering on VOD pretty soon, and I'll put all that information in the show notes, and plus it was in the interviews and stuff.
Yeah. So, Jawheads, this wasn't a hodgepodge of an episode that we put together. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think sometimes like episodes like this are even better because they break up the monotony, Rye, of always doing the same thing. It's nice to change things up.
And if you learned anything, it is when you get the jury duty notice in the mail, just throw it away.
Really? Don't you go to jail if you do that?
Oh, I don't know. That's what they say. It's like urban legend, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never had the guts to do so.
No, I kid. I'm glad that I served.
Yeah, you did your thing. Civic duty.
So we'll be back on schedule with a full show next week. We got to thank all our guests because we were everywhere this episode.
Yeah. Thanks to Haima Black and the Moxie Hotel for having us. Thanks to Joe Cardamone and Michael Grodner for granting those interviews.
Yeah. Thanks for Matt for really stepping in and doing a lot on this episode.
I know, right?
You was a workhorse, buddy.
That's weird. Yeah. That never happens.
We also got to thank our engineer, the man behind the glass, Phil.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. Happy to do it. I know we talked about it last week, and I will be ready by the time this one airs. I'm excited. I'm filming my first commercial for Lay Stinky Socks, my business. So I'll try and get that out in the show notes for Matt.
Oh, sweet.
Very exciting.
We'll review and critique your commercial.
Oh, can do. Sure. Ryan's already seen my wardrobe for it.
It's
so
hilarious.
Four jobs.
I can't wait. I can't wait. Awesome.
Sweet.
Yeah, we also got to thank the sponsors.
Yeah, thanks to Overcast and the Chicago Podcast Co-op who help us get cool sponsors like that.
Absolutely. If you want to support Cinema Jaw, you can always leave us a review on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcast.
Yeah, and click that subscribe button while you're there, please.
Until next week, I'm Ryan the Movie Guy.
And I'm Matt Kay. And keep on jawing about the movies.